Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tonight we're discussing virtual reality and its potential impact on every aspect of our lives, how we work, play, and perhaps most importantly, how we relate to one another. Is virtual reality going to make it possible for us to feel closer to others without sharing the same physical space? Well, experts in the field say yes, and for the first time in human history, we'll be able to induce sensations of intimacy with others through technology. What will this mean for the way we relate and connect to other people? Joining me here in the studio tonight to explore this topic is Peter Rubin. He's senior editor at Wired and author of the recently published book, Future Presence, How Virtual Reality is Changing Human Connection, Intimacy, and the Limits of Ordinary Life. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, Joseph. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And we will also invite our listeners to join our conversation in about 20 minutes by dialing our toll-free number. That's 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So I wanted to start really basic and tell us, if you had to describe this in 30 seconds to someone who's never heard about virtual reality, what exactly is it?
30 seconds, that's a good challenge. If you've never seen it before, virtual reality tends to come in, it's a headset, and it basically looks like a box that covers your eyes. And inside that box are a couple of screens, and taken together, they simulate a 3D image. And more importantly, as you move around, the view that you get of the virtual environment on the screens makes it feel like you are inside an all-encompassing space, meaning if you turn all the way around in your chair, you will see the back of the room. If you look up, you'll see what's up. If you see down, you'll see what's down. And you can even move around within and interact with objects within the environment.
So it's really immersing yourself in an experience. And how does it look if you're actually looking at these images? Do they look lifelike? Are they, you know, are they sometimes, you could tell that they're like a computer-generated image? Like, what's the experience like?
They run the absolute gamut. This could be anything from a still photograph or a video, and so what you are looking at is completely photorealistic. These could also be computer generated, and in that sense, they can range from incredibly abstracted, even psychedelic visuals to things that are computer generated but look as good as the special effects in a movie or a top of the line video game.
And this technology has been around for a while, correct?
Decades.
So tell us where it started.
Well, it really began to go all the way back to the beginning. If people remember from their childhoods, the stereoscopes that we used to look at, and you'd put in an image at the end of this thing, and it was two nearly identical images side by side. And when you looked at them, your eyes would basically merge the two images, and the difference between them would create the illusion of depth, or that's how you'd have a 3D photograph that you could look at. That was in the 1890s, you know, and that persisted through to ViewMasters and things like that, and these staples of our childhoods. In the late 1960s, there was a professor who created what is known as the first head-mounted display. And what that means is it was a display that you held in front of your space and your face. And this was so big, it was mounted from the ceiling. So it was actually called the Sword of Damocles. But when you looked through it around the room, you could put computer-generated objects that would seem to be persistent in space. This got turned into flight simulator experiences. So that's really where virtual reality research took off in the 1970s and 1980s. In the 1980s, things jumped out of the labs of the Air Force and NASA and into consumer technology. So especially around here in Silicon Valley, people may know the name Jaron Lanier. He is the co-founder of a company called VPL Research. They created the first kind of consumer products, whether this was a headset or what was called a data glove that you could use to kind of grab and gesture in virtual reality.
Like that real microphone
like
in front of you.
Like that real microphone that I just bumped into. Pardon my gesticulations. And in the 1990s is when virtual reality first became portrayed in popular culture in a real way. So if people remember movies like Lawnmower Man or Johnny Mnemonic, it even popped up in 80s and 90s television shows like Mad About You and Murder, She Wrote. And then it just disappeared because what you needed to make this an immersive and stable, comfortable technology simply was too expensive and too heavy and too lots of things. But then in the meantime, something called a smartphone came along. And because of smartphones, all of a sudden we had screens and motion sensors and processors that were shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And that became the magic bullet that, or the magic key that unlocked virtual reality for us again. So it's really through the advent of the smartphone and the miniaturization of all these different components led to a few years ago, the return of virtual reality.
So in the comments you just made there, it made me think about how, you know, the internet also started from government and the military and then became commercialized, and how that has, you know, revolutionized the way we live and connect and learn. How much of a leap or a shift is virtual reality when you compare it to what the internet brought us? Or is it a completely, and, you know, no pun intended here, is a completely different dimension that we're talking about?
That's exactly right. I mean, the virtual reality stands on the shoulders of the internet in the way that much of it is experienced through some sort of networked connection, just like the internet is. The difference between the two is that we interact with the internet through mediation, through phones, through computers, and through our smart televisions, through all these objects, and there's always a screen. There's always a keyboard and a mouse, or we use our fingers to tap things. There's always this remove. And what virtual reality does is by creating the illusion that you are inside the space, you are effectively going through this rectangle that has always separated us from information and from other people, meaning monitors and things like that. So once you've gone inside the frame, it does absolutely add an entirely new dimension to the way we think about the internet. And certainly you can do things in virtual reality that we are used to from the internet. You can talk to people who are miles away. You can watch things that are streaming. And in that sense, they might be rendered just like a screen that's hovering in space. You can still have the internet in virtual reality. You can also have a lot of other things in virtual reality. It creates a space where nearly anything is possible if people are willing to create that experience that you have.
So then what does virtual reality add besides that immersion that you've been talking about? What are things that you can't do with the internet that you can do with virtual reality?
Well, you can't be in someone's space. You can't sit in someone's room and watch them. You can't listen to a musician sit at a piano and compose a song while you sit in his apartment, and you can't turn around physically in wherever you're sitting in your headset. You turn around and in your headset you see his dog sleeping in a patch of sun on the floor behind you. It brings you into other people's lives and other people's experiences in a way that feels unbelievably intimate. And much has been made of the way virtual reality can induce empathy. Certainly in the early days of the technology, a lot of documentaries were created, especially by journalistic outlets like the New York Times and the Guardian. And these all sought to help you walk a mile in another person's shoes, for lack of a better term. And it's a cliche, but it really is very possible. And so by bringing people to a yak herder's home and sitting with a family and having dinner, or going to a refugee camp and sitting in a young girl's house having a meal with her family, or seeing how people are in their unguarded lives, you really experience another person's experience in a way that does induce empathy. But that's long been a talking point for virtual reality. And in my mind, it didn't quite go far enough, because when you bring another person into virtual reality with you, and I don't mean a filmed experience where you are watching someone who was already recorded and you just are existing within the space of that recording, but another person who's really there, and they may be 10 feet away or a mile away or 1,000 miles away on the other side of the planet. But when you're in there, the headset that you're wearing is tracked, and so are the hand controllers that you're holding. And what that means is, when you're sitting and talking to another person in virtual reality, you move your hands around, just like I did when I smacked the mic stand a few minutes ago. Those are my natural mannerisms. And the way I move my head when I talk is another one of those natural mannerisms. Those come through in virtual reality. So if you were to have a conversation with someone in virtual reality who you knew, you would think it's really them. They look a little different, because the way that we are represented in virtual reality, our avatars, tend to be cartoonish or abstracted, and we can tweak them and make them look as much or as little like us as we want to. We could also make ourselves look totally different if we want to. But the person that's inside us is going to come through because we are speaking with our voices in real time with a person, and they're embodied in virtual reality just like we're embodied in virtual reality. And embodiment is just a term that means you are really occupying an avatar, and the head and the hands of that avatar are moving exactly the way your head and hands are. Meaning if you shake your head no, that comes through in your avatar. If you nod your head yes, that comes through in your avatar. If we were sitting, you and I right now, in a virtual studio, and you were sitting in your home, wherever it is, and I was sitting in my home across the bay in Oakland, yet we were still both sitting at this table in virtual reality, I would see you nodding right now. And if I turn around and look over my left shoulder, you would see that, because that's what the track devices that we're using in virtual reality are communicating. And so there is this feeling of togetherness that's not an illusion. It's a togetherness because you really are together, so much so that personal space exists, that if we were to get closer, my voice would change in your ears because the audio is also spatialized in 360 degrees. So if I moved to the other side of you and I spoke, you would hear my voice coming into your right ear rather than your left ear. If we were to lean towards each other, our voices would change in that way. The audio and the visuals are so perfectly tracked and rendered for that spatial dynamic that all the hallmarks of an in-person interaction are preserved. It's really
remarkable. And yet there's a headset you're wearing, and the avatar doesn't actually look like the person that you're talking to. So how is it that your mind, your brain moves through all of those things that would say, this isn't real, to having you have that experience that says, wow, this is real?
So the foundation of all this is a phenomenon that's called presence. And in the early days of virtual reality, early days meaning the 1990s, people would refer to this as the conversion moment. And it just means that when you are wearing a headset, it's a stable, smooth, and comfortable enough experience that your reptilian brain forgets. Your rational brain is always going to know, at least for the foreseeable future, that you're wearing a headset, because what you're seeing is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be a little bit computer generated. You may see the space between the pixels in the display, you know, small cues that let you know that you're not really in it, where the virtual environment is. However, because that tracking is so accurate, what it does is it allows your brain to buy into the laws of the reality that's being presented to you. And so your emotional and even physical reactions will be in keeping with that. A good example of what presence can induce is there's a very popular category of demonstrations in which you put on a headset and you are standing on the edge of some sort of a ledge. Could be the ledge of a skyscraper hundreds of feet off the ground. It could be about 10 feet off the ground. And whoever is in the real life room with you will say to you, and you'll be able to hear them, they'll say, lift up your foot and with your body and take a step forward. And your rational brain will say, oh, I'm standing in this room. This isn't real. I know I can do that and nothing's going to happen. I'm going to shift my weight forward and my foot will just land on the same rug that I'm standing on. But because of presence, you will find it unbelievably, surprisingly difficult to do that. Something is stopping you. There is this paralysis. And you will sometimes, some people just simply aren't able to do it. Some people fight through it. But when you lift up your leg and you shift your weight forward and you fall onto your next foot, there is a moment nearly every time of saying, what if? And that what if is presence, because your brain has bought into the virtual environment that you're being presented. So that presence. Now, because of presence, your brain is able to fill in an astonishing number of gaps. And I'll give you another example of what that might look like. A very popular set of demos that shipped with one of the first headsets that became available a couple of years ago. You were standing in front of a mirror. And what you saw in that mirror would change. It could be a red balloon. It could be a mask. It could be a pendant that was like a stylized version of the sun. But no matter what was being shown back to you as your reflection, the way you moved your head when you looked at it, you'd move it back and forth and you'd move your chin around and you'd see what your reflection did. And it would be exact and it would be immediate because the tracking is so powerful. So whatever your headset was doing would be reflected back to you through this other shape. Mm-hmm. And no matter what the object was, you know you're not a red balloon, but because of the perfection of the way it mirrored your movements, you would see yourself in it, whether or not facial features were on this balloon. And so that goes a lot of the way to explaining why if you are talking to someone in virtual reality and their avatar doesn't look exactly like them, it might not even have a nose. Mm-hmm. But if it has a representation of a face and it sounds like the person because it's the person's real voice and it moves like the person because it is the real person's movements, you will overlook all the abstraction and all the cartoonishness, and you will leave that experience saying, this is a conversation I had with that person.
And there's a part in your book where you talk about how that actually perhaps you can actually make memories of virtual reality experiences and not be able to distinguish them from others.
It's the way we store them. So we all remember things that we've seen. We remember scenes from movies. But if you think back to seeing a movie, part of what comes along is where you were when you saw the movie. I was in the theater. Oh, I was watching it on the couch with my sister, whatever it is. So there has been this kind of long, ongoing discussion of what you do in virtual reality. Do you remember it like it's something you looked at, like a photograph or a movie, or do you remember it like it's something that you experienced? Is it stored in your autobiographical memory? So a year and change ago, a team of researchers in Germany decided to put this to the test in a way that hadn't been done before. And they took a GoPro, a twin GoPro, that action camera, and they put it on a motorcycle rider's helmet. And the motorcycle rider went for a ride in the German countryside. And he came back with all this footage that was basically taken from the view of the rider. And because it was two GoPros, you could put it together and turn it into a single three-dimensional image. And they showed that footage to people one of two ways. You could either watch the footage of the motorcycle ride on a giant TV that was right in front of your face, or you could watch it in a virtual reality headset. And if you watched it in a virtual reality headset, you would also keep your hands on a pair of motorcycle handlebars that were mounted on the table in front of you just to give that little extra kick of verisimilitude. After that, the researchers tested all the participants by showing them images of the countryside. And they said, is this something that you saw on the motorcycle ride, or is this just another still photo from another part of the German countryside? The people who had experienced the footage in virtual reality outperformed on the memory test the people who had looked at it on the television screen, which isn't entirely surprising. People who've done things in VR tend to have stronger memories for things like memory tests. But the interesting thing is the people who had experienced this in virtual reality took just a touch longer to answer on average each time. And that is consistent with the fact that the memories were stored in the part of the brain that's consistent with an autobiographical memory, an actual experiential memory. Where that's stored and how that's processed, it takes a little longer to get to and retrieve than the memory of being shown an image, just like playing a game of concentration. So for the first time, we have findings that are consistent with the idea that your memory of something you experience in virtual reality is indistinguishable from your memory of that, the real life version of that experience. And that's borne out in the idea that if you connect with somebody, a relative or a stranger in virtual reality, and you pick the setting, maybe it's a panda zoo in China, maybe it's the surface of Mars, that becomes the sense memory. It becomes, oh, where was I? Where was I when I was talking to Henry about that? That was at the panda zoo. That becomes the memory. Not I put on a headset and talked to Henry. It's I had this conversation with Henry and this is where it happened. Because everything else about your experience is not an illusion. The conversation that you had, him hearing your voice, you hearing his voice, the way our hands move, the way our heads moved, even increasingly our eye contact and our facial expression, which is going to be brought into virtual reality in the next year or two. And so all the nonverbal cues that we're used to in our real-world interactions and which we have sacrificed in our internet-mediated interactions come roaring back in virtual reality. I think everyone who has had a Skype video call or a FaceTime call with someone on their phone, they know that while you're looking at the other person, there's a weird sort of alienating phenomenon that occurs, and that is you are looking at the person on your screen and they're looking at the person on their screen, but your eyes don't meet each other because the camera of the phone that's looking at you isn't where the other person's eyes are looking. So even if you have a FaceTime call with a person, mm-hmm. you're looking at their face and they're looking at your face, but you're not making eye contact. In virtual reality, you're actually making eye contact. So there's this other thing, this kind of spine of that interpersonal moment is restored again. So even our most immersive internet-enabled simulations of remote contact lose these things, and virtual reality restores these things.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 local public radio, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking with Peter Rubin. He's the author of Future Presence, How Virtual Reality is Changing Human Connection, Intimacy, and the Limits of Ordinary Life. And he also is senior editor at Wired. And we're talking about virtual reality, what it is, and now we're going to talk about how it's going to change our lives and what do we have to look out for in terms of the glory and perhaps some of the risks. We invite you, our listeners, to join in to our conversation as the hour unfolds. Have you tried virtual reality? What's your take on it? What do you think about what Peter's talking about? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment to the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So I have to say, the first thing that came into my mind when you were talking about this is kind of like the what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Just the things that happen in virtual reality stay in virtual reality, or can experiences you have there kind of be regulated or prosecuted if they cross a line? Like, because you're talking about a virtual platform and yet a very visceral, real experience. So what really happens to you there, and how does it cross over into the usual way we think about things that happen to us in the real world?
That's somehow a million-dollar question that has wrapped up within it a bunch of $64,000 questions. Like, what you just asked is one of the thorny, wonderful things that no one knows the answer to. And I try to I try to engage with these ideas in the book, certainly. And I should also point out that the entire, I guess, motivation of the book is to make this accessible and graspable for people who don't know a lot about it. It's very much geared to people who have maybe heard of virtual reality, don't have a lot of experience with it. It's very much set up almost as a travelogue. I try to bring people inside the headset as much as I can and to talk to the people who have created these experiences and the people who are using virtual reality and kind of the social patterns that are emerging in surprising ways. So the question is what happen in virtual reality stay in virtual reality? And there are a lot of different ways that becomes a really interesting and difficult question to answer. One of them is the idea that behaviors that have unfortunately become par for the course on the internet and social media as a whole take on an entirely new resonance in virtual reality. So anyone who has spent any time on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or what have you knows that casual cruelty has become one of the hallmarks of social media, unfortunately. And sometimes people mean to, and sometimes people don't. But it's very easy from behind a screen to fire off something hurtful at somebody or to really deliberately make their life uncomfortable. Harassment campaigns, slurs, horrible images that you share with people, all that stuff is
scams,
which is we'll get to that in a second. That's an entirely other category of abuse. So what to a troll is a very easy thing to dash off in a mediated communications technology like a phone or a laptop and through a social media engine.
That's someone who's trying to harass someone through a social media platform, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In virtual reality, when you are embodied and the other person is embodied, meaning you have a body in there, means you also have personal space, and that personal space can be invaded. And when you can walk up to somebody and whisper something horrible in their ear, and it really is like someone is walking up to you and whispering something horrible in your ear, or even bring their hands into your personal space, whether it's your face or your body, something that was a nuisance and certainly could be traumatic in conventional social media, the viscerality of virtual reality amplifies that a thousandfold, if not more. And so sexual harassment has certainly happened in multi-user spaces in virtual reality and is one of its most pressing problems. The trolling instinct, certainly there's an argument that virtual reality makes it more difficult for someone to be a casual troll because it makes everyone more accountable for their actions. There's no longer that detachment. If you're going to make someone's day worse, you really have to mean to. You have to walk up to them. You have to really intend to do this, and you have to own it because it's you. You're not an anonymous username. You might be an anonymous person. And we'll talk more about anonymity and what that affords and also brings up. But sexual harassment and toxic speech, even physical harassment, all of these become hairier and much more troubling in virtual reality. So the people who are creating the platforms and the spaces where this multi-user interaction occurs are trying all sorts of things. They're giving people larger personal space bubbles so that if someone comes inside that personal space bubble, they will effectively disappear from your view. Things like the ability to ban people from a space. These are things that are kind of hallmarks of multiplayer gaming as that has become kind of beset by bad actors and trolls. But what's still emerging is the idea that virtual reality, while the people that use it very much want it to succeed, it's not necessarily a safe, positive space all the time. So there's a huge burden on the people that are creating these platforms and creating these spaces to anticipate and preempt the issues that could come around. The other thing you bring up, which is fraud in all its manifold incarnations. On the internet, there's something called catfishing, and that is when you present yourself to somebody as someone you're not, you create an emotional dependence, you manipulate them. That takes on an all-new resonance in virtual reality. We haven't seen it yet necessarily, but we can imagine. Financial scams, the famous Nigerian prince scam where you get an email, and phishing email scams. All of these, while they're not happening yet in virtual reality, we can certainly imagine a world in which an older person puts on their headset, they go into a space, and they see someone who looks like their grandson. And the grandson says, "Hi, Grandpa. Hi, Grandma. I wanted to send you something for your birthday. I just wanted to make sure that I had your routing number and bank account number so I could just put it directly in there." We have always, on the internet, dealt with the idea of verifying our identities. But something that we're going to need to start grappling with in the future is the need to verify and authenticate an experience, not just an identity. So there's harassment on one side and there's fraudulent behavior in its many ways on the other side. These are two of what, to me, are the most pressing concerns that we have coming at us. You know, certainly by virtue of having written a book about virtual reality, I find myself being cast as a techno-optimist, and I think if I had to come down on one side or the other, I certainly believe in virtual reality and mixed reality's promise. I do think, though, that much more care needs to be taken in the early days of the technology and the growth of the technology than maybe what was taken in the early days of the internet, when we had an explosion of businesses and people were making money and people were prioritizing growth and scaling over the user experience. We've seen what happened with Twitter. We've seen what happened with Instagram. The people who are creating these worlds in virtual reality where multiple people can come together, they've seen that movie, the movie called The Internet, and they don't want to see a sequel. So people are working on it. But part of this is when you have a new technology, someone who really wants to abuse it is going to find a way to abuse it. So there's going to be a cat and mouse element to this, certainly.
So that all that means is that we know that the internet has taught us some lessons, and if you know, history serves us right here, it's just going to continue and be amplified, as you say. And then there's going to be perhaps terrain that we can't even imagine right now. And of course, this is always the issue that comes up when we talk about new technology, is how do our social mores, how do our legal constructs, how do they keep pace with how fast the technology is moving when we can't even fully predict what the experience or the scope of experience is going to be like. So could you imagine this actually being different because we have a little bit of a head start because we know what we know from the internet? Or is it going to be hit or miss, fits and starts, like we with any other new technology?
I think we're going to fumble towards it. And I think there are going to be missteps. And I think in aggregate, it's probably going to take too long and do too little in the beginning. I think as we saw from the testimony that Mark Zuckerberg gave to both the House and the Senate a couple of weeks ago, the questions that were coming from our elected officials don't always give us the most confidence that they know exactly what's going on. So my best guess is that something terrible is going to precipitate true action. But I do think that at some point we're going to have some sort of a regulatory approach, whether that's regulatory through the FCC or FTC or something that's more statutory, an actual kind of criminal statute. The question becomes there are things that we don't know yet. There are acid tests, like what constitutes a physical crime when it happens in VR? What constitutes sexual violence when it happens in VR? What constitutes evidence in VR? And that is, thankfully, just because to go back to the original, what happens in VR stays in VR. There is the ability, certainly, to record your view of virtual reality. I've recorded a number of videos kind of talking to a virtual camera, talking about various things, just as a way to make little videos talking about what's happening in VR. And it's becoming increasingly popular on game streaming platforms like Twitch, which is where people live stream the video games they're playing. People can do that in VR as well. So there can be a record. There can be a capture of what happened in virtual reality. But there's also the very real possibility that a lot of stuff will happen and no record of it having happened. So it will be much more like a real-world he said, she said, Rashomon type of scenario.
And when you talked about the Mark Zuckerberg's testimony on Capitol Hill recently, it made me think about the fact that Facebook bought Oculus, which is this big VR company, and with the intent of sort of, again, taking the Facebook experience and I'd say put it on steroids or something like that. How has the recent scrutiny of Facebook and the security of private information, how is that going to change how Facebook proceeds here?
Well, there's a lot that's been—
Or other companies.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot that's been happening, and Facebook perhaps more than anyone has been under the microscope, not only because of what's happening at Facebook as we know it, but because as the owner of one of the largest virtual reality companies, Oculus, Facebook has one of the most popular headsets and lines of headsets that there is. And so a few things have happened. One is that recently, because of the GDPR, Oculus has announced that they're—
GDPR?
I forget what the G stands for. Thanks a lot. Data protection. You can do this, right?
I can't.
This is a data privacy act, and it is it's taking place in a lot of other countries and not necessarily in the U.S. So a lot of companies are taking advantage of the opportunity to overhaul their privacy policies, make as many things as explicit as they can. Oculus is among those. So a week or two ago, they announced that they were overhauling their privacy policy, making explicit all these various things. The question becomes, what happens when technologies make their way into a virtual reality headset that we don't have yet? And the perfect example of that, because that's going to be coming within the next year, is gaze tracking. Sensors inside a headset are going to be able to track your eyes. And there are a host of benefits from this. It enables people who create experiences to devote all the computing power only to what your eyes are focusing on and not to the entirety of the environment, which is good for kind of efficient processing. It's really good for inputting your choices and text, and so it may help with neck fatigue and eye strain and other things like that. And for me, most importantly, it makes interpersonal communication much more naturalistic. We already have eye contact in VR, but it's simulated. We can't see exactly where our eyes are looking. With eye tracking, if you and I were in VR having this conversation, we would see each other blink. I would see your eyes flick over my shoulder to look through the window at your producer or whatever it is. And it's just another kind of level of immersion. However, when your eyes are tracked in a headset, what that raises the specter of is this treasure trove of data that every advertiser in the world would love to get their hands on. Not just what you look at, but how long you look at it. And the next step after that is what reaction your face makes when you look at these things. So a huge part of privacy policies right now, both on the headset side and for the people who actually create the eye tracking technology, is building into the privacy policies that the data of your eyes will not be stored on the device and will not be sent anywhere. It's used only in the moment to make your experience better. But that's one example of something that could easily become a privacy nightmare.
Wow. Once again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we are talking with Peter Rubin, senior editor at Wired and author of the new book, Future Presence: How Virtual Reality is Changing Human Connection, Intimacy, and the Limits of Ordinary Life. Again, our phone lines are open if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You could also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, interestingly enough, we spent a lot of time talking about the dystopian view of what virtual reality could be. Why don't we shift gears for a moment and talk about sort of how could this change our day-to-day lives? How does change industry, in a way that is more in line with your optimism?
Well, what we're seeing already, I think, bears out the optimism, or at least validates the optimism. And that is, before we even kind of get to the thrust of the book, design and education and medicine and engineering, all of these are already seeing transformative effects of virtual reality. And that's because of virtual reality's ability to let you visualize any object that you can imagine and interact with it. So a couple of years ago, a pediatric surgeon in Florida needed to do a cardiac procedure on an infant. He had one chance to do it, tiny heart. So beforehand, he used a virtual reality headset and they created a large visualization of this infant's heart exactly, millimeter accuracy. And so he's able to basically do a dry run, know exactly what he needed to do, where he needed to turn. And afterwards, he attributed his success with the procedure to the fact that he'd been able to do this. With education, the ability to bring kids to art and cultural resources that either they're geographically removed from, take them to the Louvre, take them to experiences, take them to the surface of the moon or to Mars, like I mentioned before. And so we're already seeing a number of industries be kind of reshaped by what virtual reality allows us to do. Now, with interpersonal stuff, this is the stuff that's just beginning. This is the book coming out now is as much taking the first couple of years of consumer virtual reality, seeing what has come out of that and extrapolating to see where this is going to go in 5 years. So there's a healthy bit of speculation, educated speculation, I like to think, but it's all rooted in how people are using it now.
So say more about that. Say how the interpersonal realm, I mean, we talked a little bit about what the experience could be like, some of the pitfalls and concerns, but where do you see this go? Where is it now and where do you see it going? Because, again, when you're talking about virtual reality, you do have to suspend your disbelief that this experience can feel and be so real such to as to induce memories. How are people going to use this technology to relate to one another in a way that is different from or maybe even impossible in the real world?
The best place to look before we get to the places where people are actually doing this, a good precursor is the therapeutic applications of virtual reality. It's proven to be remarkable for post-traumatic stress disorder and phobia disorders because you can bring people into an environment that would normally be hugely traumatic, and you can do it in a safe way, and you can do it with a guide, and you can repeat it again and again and again, so your sensitivity to that lessens over time. And so how that translates into the way people are using VR is, amazingly enough, people who have social anxieties have found virtual reality to be this remarkably liberating technology. Up until now, because of the internet, we kind of think about relationships in two different ways. You have a real-world relationship in which you meet someone casually and you get to know each other casually, and it takes time, and you don't disclose much of yourself in the beginning. It's all small talk. And over time, you get to know that person a little bit more. You get to know not just how they act when you're sitting with them and talking with them, but what their fears are and what their history is and all these things. And so you get the surface stuff very quickly, and you get the interior stuff very slowly. When the internet came around, because of the kind of unbridled anonymity, the famous idea that no one on the internet, no one knows you're a dog, people could make themselves be whoever they wanted to be. And because there were these incredibly low stakes, because you were anonymous and you were pretending to be someone else, you could, in many ways, become very vulnerable very quickly. And so in chat rooms and message boards and multi-user communities, you would often see people get to the point of disclosure very, very quickly. And people would have in-jokes and people would profess their love for one another. But when these people would take their relationship from online, offline, what they would often find is that the person that they met in real life was not the person that they had built up a mental image of, because the personality wasn't quite the same. If you're curating yourself all the time because you have the time sitting at a keyboard to come up with the perfect response to anything, take your time, be as witty as you always wished you were, or whatever it is, then you meet someone in reality. Not only is there the awkwardness of meeting someone for the first time, but there's the pressure of living up to this self that you have presented to someone else. So whereas in real life, you get to know someone on the surface very quickly and you get to know their interior self very slowly, on the internet, it was almost the other way around. You would get to know someone's interior self very quickly, but it wouldn't always match up with the person. Virtual reality brings these two things together in this really remarkable way that is uniquely well-suited to people with social anxieties. Now, when you go in, I talked a little bit about kind of the rational brain and the reptilian brain, and the reptilian brain kind of buys into VR, and that's what presence is. But your rational brain will tell yourself, if you have social anxiety and you go into a multi-user space, you're going to say, you know what? These people don't know me. If I freak out, I'll just take off the headset. And it's lower stakes than walking into a party and feeling weird about walking out of a party, or walking into a bar and walking out of a bar. The barrier to entry and the barrier to exit feel so low that you're more liable to try it. And you might not have a great time, but just as VR is good for getting over phobias and PTSD, you're able to reenact that experience again. So it gets a little easier. So for people who do this again and again, and they start to form these relationships in VR, this third track starts to emerge, where because there's a little bit of anonymity, you are a little bit emboldened, just like you might be on the internet. But because your real self is coming through, this is in real time. You're speaking with your voices. You don't have time to curate yourself. Your, as we talked about before, your physical mannerisms come through, the way you move your head and your hands, what you do when you talk, how you move your hands. And so if you meet someone in real life after getting to know them in VR, the overwhelming sensation is, this is the same person. So I have spent time with people in VR and then met them in real life, or had Skype calls with them after they'd met in real life. This is a story that's chronicled in the book. And it's remarkable how little awkwardness there was. So we've seen these close-knit communities come together in virtual reality that spills over the edges back into the real world again, because these are real-world interactions that we're having. The interactions and the relationships that we form through conventional internet tend to be mediated in all these different ways, and that falls away when you're just talking with someone in real time.
So tell us that story about the couple who met in virtual reality, and I'll leave it there, and then you can tell us how it ended.
So there's the story can be told in two different ways. It's told one way in the book, and then for the excerpt that we ran in the April issue of Wired magazine, which I think just left the stand, but you can still find it online, we started at the end and we went back to the beginning. So I'll start at the beginning, and at the beginning it's a story of a young woman named Priscilla and a young man named Ben. And she was in Alabama and he was in Ohio. And they both got headsets within a few months of each other. And they both ended up trying the same multi-user VR platform. This is something called Rec Room. And it's one of between 5 and 10 social VR universes that you can kind of go and spend time in and navigate. Rec Room is an interesting one in that it's built around this sort of gym class locker room metaphor, and like you have your own dorm room and then you go out in the locker room and you meet people and then you can go out and play different games or you can go into other rooms and hang out. It's very, they call it structured free time because that's the people that make it want it to feel that way. They want it to feel like there's stuff to do if that's an icebreaker to get to know people. But once you know people, they want to give you places where you can just go and hang out. So both Ben and Priscilla, by their own admission, have always had trouble forming real life relationships. Priscilla is an artist and she works from home and she just didn't see people a lot. Ben was, as a college student, he was a commuter and he works for his family business. And so both of them after college kind of found themselves kind of bereft of a lot of close friendships. So they both started spending time separately in this place called Rec Room. And the first time Priscilla tried it, she hated it. She cried. She, like I was saying before, she tore the headset off. But because that barrier to try it again was so low, she tried it again. And before long, they kind of fell in with the same group of people. And they would get together in virtual reality, and they would play, you know, they'd play something together. They'd play paintball or laser tag or something silly. Or then they'd all go into a room. And in their own real-world rooms, all of them, in their own place, they might have a drink or they might smoke something, and they would just hang out and talk into the wee hours of the night, 3-4 nights a week. And this became this incredible community. So much so that people would create Instagram profiles that never showed real people, only showed Rec Room characters, that only showed avatars. You knew these people by their avatars. And so Ben and Priscilla became very close, and they started texting with each other and doing kind of communicating in the same ways that people do on the internet. And Priscilla had long said, you know, I want someone to come visit me. And Ben said, I'll do it. So he drove down from Ohio, and he met her in Alabama. And I had spent time with them both in VR, and I jumped on a video call with them because they were both in the same place and they only had one headset, so I couldn't spend time with both of them in VR at the same time. So we opted for what now feels like the Stone Age alternative, which is a video call through Skype. And they seemed a little jittery around each other. They'd already been hanging out for 3 or 4 days, so I kind of asked what was going on. And after I got off the call, they texted me and said, you know, yeah, we kissed. And so they kind of started getting this long-distance romance going, and it didn't really catch, and so it kind of fell apart. But there was another person who was a member of their friend group, and this was a guy named Mark. Mark lived in Washington State, so even farther away. He had helped his mother move. He had lived somewhere else, and his mother had retired, so he helped her move and get settled, and he bought a house in the same town. And it was a town that was really friendly for senior community, but not for a guy in his 30s who didn't want to drive 2.5 hours to Seattle to find a social scene. So he, too, was spending time in VR. And he was friends with Priscilla and Ben. And then after Ben and Priscilla fell apart, Mark had stopped spending quite as much time. And eventually he came back. And when he came back, he and Priscilla found that something had kind of changed. And they both had had these kind of secret crushes on each other in VR. But the more they talked, and by now Rec Room could allowed them to do other things. They could kind of create objects and give them to each other and all these other things. And he said, I think I want to come visit. And she said, I want you to come visit. And just in case, he brought a ring. He said, I want to know. He said to his mom before he left, I have a feeling that this woman I'm going to go see might be the one. And we've heard this story. We've heard this story with every internet community you can imagine. But when he went, the person that he met was exactly the person that he knew. So they met on a Tuesday, and they were engaged on a Thursday, and they got married by a justice of the peace the next day. And then they redid the ceremony in virtual reality so all their friends could attend. So there was an officiant, there was a procession, there was a cake, there was a bouquet that they could throw over their shoulder. Ben, the original guy who had been interested in Priscilla, DJ'd the wedding. And the first dance that the married couple had, they were dancing. There's a video of it. You can see the video. And in virtual reality, they're holding each other and they're dancing. And in the real world, he hadn't yet moved to Alabama. So he was in Washington State and she was in Alabama, and they were 2,600 miles apart having their first dance as man and wife. And now they live together in Alabama and are very happy.
That's quite a story. So how common do you think this is going to be?
It's difficult to say. A number of romances have certainly sprouted out of this, more friendships than I can count. So whether or not the story of Mark and Priscilla, it becomes a standard trope, I don't think is necessarily going to happen for a while, because you need, just like with online dating, you started with a very small pool and then it got more and more mainstream. Virtual reality doesn't have the degree of cultural ubiquity that it needs for that to become a widespread phenomenon. However, if that becomes a place where people are spending more of their leisure and social time, stands to reason that those stories are going to become more and more commonplace.
So we have about, you know, 6-7 minutes left in the program. I wanted to take this forward. Where do you see this going next? How do you imagine this unfolding in terms of scaling up its you know, uptake? People, you know, adopting this technology. What do you see in the future?
Well, the thing that's most important in the short term is making virtual reality headsets easier to use and easier to have, and thankfully that's just beginning to happen. This month sees the launch of the first two what are called standalone headsets, and that means up until now headsets have either had to connect to a powerful PC computer or video game console, in which case you had cables snaking from your headset to this other machine, or you'd have to slap your smartphone into it and it would run off the sensors in your smartphone and use the screen of your smartphone. So both of those have their problems. In one, you're tethered, and in the other, it's just kind of not that immersive an experience. However, these standalone devices are self-contained. There are no wires. They turn on and they turn off. They don't need a phone. Everything that you need to have virtual reality is in there. And so we're going to see this category emerge, and it's going to deliver a kind of a continuum of experience from things that are a little more casual to things that are much more fully featured and more like what you get with a high-powered PC headset. So that, to me, is an absolutely crucial step. So the emergence of these standalone headsets, which is just now beginning, in fact, this week people will be hearing some news about them, that is a short-term step. And then long-term, what's going to happen is that virtual reality is going to merge with its cousin, which is called mixed reality by some people, or augmented reality. And that is, rather than surrounding yourself in a virtual environment, you are bringing virtual objects into our real world surroundings. That's through it's still a wearable that you have on your face, but it's transparent, and instead things are kind of beamed into your eyes, but you still see the world around you. And so these two technologies are going to eventually, whether this is 5 years from now, 10 years from now, be available in a single device. And as that device shrinks and becomes lighter, more comfortable, more powerful, it will become an all-day device. Not because we want to spend all our time in VR, but because we will be very used to using the kind of augmented mixed reality capabilities to have things like notifications or our emails pop up if we want them to as we're walking down the street. If you remember what Google Glass was, which was well ahead of its time and a very, very kind of low-powered version of that. It's going to be that, but with three-dimensional heft, with the ability to, you know, pull up a model and place it on the table in front of us. And we're both sitting in the same real-world room, but we can look at the same virtual object and share it between us. So that's going to be what transforms work. And then when you go home, the same device will be able to be used for something that is occlusive, for something that you can sink into an immersive experience in which you can sink into something that is entirely virtual. So the same device will be able to accommodate a number of different use cases, and that's when it will become truly a thing that people are kind of used to us wearing. They'll be unobtrusive. They won't feel like you're wearing a computer on your face. It'll become much more casual, and there won't be quite so much hand-wringing about people disappearing into it, like some of the doomsday fears around VR.
Right, because that's the other, you know, internet addiction is well documented and discussed. How would this be different?
Well, the particular Chicken Little phenomenon about virtual reality is we're going to never want to leave because it'll be better than reality. And when you bring someone else into that equation, it changes that problem for me. If you are having real experiences with people, whether that setting is virtual or not, that's not escapism to me. That's connection.
So I think that is the question of how can we turn something that could be escape into true connection. And it sounds like it's this, the immersion, it's the what you call presence that kind of glues it all together. So where is this all being developed? Is it Silicon Valley? Is other parts of the world that are working on it?
It's all over the place. Silicon Valley, certainly, and a lot of the hardware is being worked on here. Oculus is based at Facebook, which is in Menlo Park. They also have – there are a number of companies based in the Pacific Northwest. Seattle is a big place for VR research, and the experiences that are being built are everywhere. Southern California is a hotbed of it for shared experiences. There are people in Seattle and New York. China is a huge virtual reality market that a lot of what's being done there and in a lot of other regions of the world is turning VR into a destination. So people will go to facilities in order to experience kind of immersive multi-user VR. So there it's almost more of an attraction and what's called location-based virtual reality. And that's catching on here as well. There are these VR arcades and really high-end kind of bespoke experiences are proliferating all over the country at IMAX facilities and places like that. And so what's kind of amazing about it is in that way, it's very much like the video game industry in which you can have a huge influential company that's based in North Carolina or wherever. It's just where you can attract the talent and where people are thinking creatively about how to make compelling connecting virtual reality.
So if someone wants to experience this, what can they do if they don't want to plunk down the cash to get one of the...
Yeah, I mean, you can have it yourself. There's thankfully now a pretty wide distribution of price points. But if you want a completely no-commitment experience, you can go to a number of facilities that offer this. What that's going to do is it's going to limit your view of virtual reality to these entertainment applications, certainly. That's where people are going to these things to play games and to do movie tie-in experiences. But it's enough to give you a sense of how presence feels, and there are enough of those experiences that have you in there with multiple other people that you can begin to get a sense of what that promise really is.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you, Peter Rubin, author of Future Presence, How Virtual Reality is Changing Human Connection, Intimacy, and the Limits of Ordinary Life. Quite an interesting and engaging conversation about virtual reality.
Thanks so much for having me on.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision's page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. Join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday as he explores the impact of technology on agriculture. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.